Today's cheer is being sponsored by Aaron Mensch to commemorate the 10th yard site of his father, Avram Tzvi Ben Shlomo Zalman. May his neshama have an aliyah. At the end of last week's cheer, we encountered the Gemara. What's that? Ah, we are on Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, yes. At the end of last week's cheer, we encountered a Gemara that left some people a little bit perturbed. So I spent a fair amount of time thinking about this. Marshall was very thoughtful in his comments last week, and Zell, I appreciate the exchange via email. I've had some time to think about it, and I want to take just a few minutes to sort of discuss the question. So let me just review the Gemara for those who don't remember it in detail, for those who weren't here last week. The Gemara had on top of Chaf, had said that Rav Papa asked Abaye a question. Why is it that the Rishonim miracles happened to the earlier generations, but our generation miracles don't happen? And the miracle he was referring to was that Rabbi Yehuda would take off one shoe when they needed rain, and rain would come flooding down. But we scream and scream and scream, and it's like there's nobody home upstairs listening to us. So Abaye said to him, because the Rishonim wore Moser Nefesh on Kiddush Hashem, and we are not Moser Nefesh on Kiddush Hashem. So he tells a story. The story he tells is of Rav Ada Bar Ahava, who saw a woman in the shuk wearing what the Gemara describes as a karbalasa. Someone mentioned in Shir last week, it's a minority opinion. Almost all the Rishonim reject this. Some Rishonim say it was shatnez, it was kilayim. Because remember that our Gemara began on your test some days, talking about if you find kilayim and you beg in the shuk, he's supposed to strip it off. Now, they suggest that because Rav Ada Bar Ahava I don't want to call it a fit of rage. It doesn't say that. It just says he tore this shawl off the woman, humiliating her. It doesn't say that he left her totally unclothed. She probably wasn't, but he clearly embarrassed her. It was an act of shaming. But most Rishonim say she was wearing this karbalasa. It was red. It was totally inappropriate garb. It was a beged of pritzus. And he tore it off her. And then it turned out she wasn't Jewish, which meant that he should have had no issue. This is not your community. It's not your communal norms. And he was taken to court. It doesn't say which court. Could have been the secular court. Could have been. He was made to pay 400 zuz, which is the fine you would have, a beis din would have assessed for busha in many cases. And he said, you know, he said either her name was Matun. So he said Matun, which is in Aramaic, Masun is 200. He did 200 plus 200. Or Masun means patience. I should have been more patient. I should have found out who you are. Maybe I should have asked you some questions. Maybe I should have understood your background. And I wouldn't have been high at 400 zuz. That was the end of the Gemara. So some people were understandably a little bit perturbed that, you know, what kind of behavior is that, right? You go into the shuk, you see someone dressed inappropriately, and you tear their garments off.
Even looking at women.
What's that? Okay, well, in looking through this, I pulled out, the Rishonim don't comment on it, really. I mean, other than to talk about what the beged is, which on some level tells you maybe they weren't that perturbed. But looking through, I found some very, very interesting sources, some which are a little too disturbing to share, from some more modern recent stories. But I want to really, Marshall had suggested in our discussion last week, or it acknowledged at least, that this was in some ways a violation of a communal norm. Let me pose the following. Not all these are, you know, I discussed this with my wife at some length, trying to find kind of an analog. What would, and this may not be perfect, but let me start with this example. What do you think of someone who goes to, I don't know, Richmond, Virginia, sees a Confederate statue, throws a rope around it and tears the statue down, pulls it down? And what is our reaction to that? Now, I suppose, obviously, there are people, different people on parts of the political spectrum, but assuming that, I'll assume for the moment that someone is not supportive of the monuments in principle and why they were erected and what they really stand for. But I could see someone might say, you know, but I think you should go through legal channels. But I could also see people would say the statue is so offensive. What it stands for essentially is slavery and the lost cause and so on, that it's such an offense to the public that it's there. We're not killing anybody in the process. We're not hurting anybody in the process. We're tearing the statue down. Or imagine the following. And again, we could talk about the legal aspects, but imagine somebody goes outside across the street from KJ, you know, rent somebody's window and posts a flag with a swastika. Imagine that. Now, and then let's say some young member of the KJ community, some young spry member goes and he tears it down. Now, it technically might be, let's put aside the legal question for the moment. The legal question, the girl was, he made a mistake, he had to pay 400 zuz. Okay. But let's just talk about, because I think the question you were asking is the ethical question, really. What kind of religious behavior is this? Is that, Zell, is that a fair way to characterize?
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And so I think some might say you shouldn't tear down the flag. You should, first, I'm not even sure there are legal channels, because this, as we know in New Jersey now, from the most case, and probably correctly determined, there is a First Amendment, which has a very, very broad protection, you know, protections of political and any kind of other speech. So forget the legal question, but I think that there are people, you know, it's not my temper. I happen not to have a temper. I'm not the one who's likely to go tear down the sign, even if I'd be deeply offended by it. But I'm not sure that's a statement of my properness. I think this is a statement of my timidity, my timidness. But I could see someone doing it, and I don't think we would shake our heads too badly. So the reason I'm sort of looking for questions is that what happens when someone engages in a behavior that is so in violation of communal norms? You know, I said, well, imagine someone walked into KJ in a certain, and we talk about people walk into shul and don't dress appropriately in various shuls based upon the norms there. Imagine someone walked into KJ and I gave a description of something and it was a woman dressed inappropriately. Now, what would some people's response be? So my wife said to me, actually, in KJ, someone would go over to the person, would say good Shabbos to them, find out who they are, maybe understand their backstory a little bit, because it's very welcoming and we want to know. Now, let's figure out, firstly, did someone behave inappropriately because they knew they were behaving inappropriately, or because literally you walk into a situation and you just don't realize that that's not in the norms of a particular place. But my point is, I'm searching for examples where someone clearly violates a communal norm, and the reaction to it can be fairly strong, because what happens when there's no reaction, we could debate, again, he didn't hit this woman, he didn't kill this woman. It's not even clear he left her totally unclothed, but he did do something to shame her. So the question is, when you don't respond strongly to violations of communal norms, what happens over time is those norms disappear. You know, I think I could be wrong, but this is something that we've observed, and it's, you know, in the modern Orthodox community, I mean, it's changed a little bit depending on which circles, but many married women don't cover their hair. But the norm in shuls that I grew up in, I think it's the norm here also, is that when a married woman goes to shul, she puts something on her head. It might be a doily, it might be a little something, but it's just kind of a sign of respect for the place. Now, we've observed over the years that particularly in the younger crowd, some women who don't cover their hair decide they come to shul, they don't cover their hair, so they come to shul this way. Now, the truth is, it's inappropriate. That's the norm in the shul. Whatever you do outside the shul, that's your business. It's not anybody else's business. But this is certainly the case. If one woman does it, and again, you take your example, it could be a man dressed inappropriately for a particular shul. Let's say, I don't know, people who walk into shorts, walk into KJ in shorts, and men walk in that way.
Soon, not yet.
Oh, okay, well. I know Marshall comes to shear that way, but I don't know if he goes to shul. Marshall's not here. I'm not having, I can't have fun with Marshall. Okay. You know,
work in shorts. I think he goes to work in shorts.
Brown shoes.
It's for Marshall. Okay. Can't believe he's missing this. But the point is, let's say you're in a shul where it's totally out of the norm. If some person walks in shorts, a man walks in shorts, if nobody says anything, you know, 2 months later, there'll be two men walking in shorts. And by the time a year has passed, it'll be normal for men to walk in shorts. Now, if that's okay, it's one thing. But if there are communal norms, then, and if that's considered to be zayon beis hakneses, you know, disrespectful to the beis hakneses, then you have to say something. I'm not saying the rabbi necessarily needs to get up from the pulpit and call someone out by name or call the behavior, but and some people would be offended even if you said something to them privately. I mean, I can't imagine such a thing, but we know that that's the case. So the question really is, when someone violates communal norms, what is the reaction? And I think, again, I think that, you know, again, it harkens back to us to what happened probably 20 years ago in places like Mea Shearim, when there were bus shelters and there were posters, ads put up in there that were deeply offensive to the inhabitants of the area. And I think mea culpa, schatani mas kariyom. So when they burned the bus shelters in some of the cases, some of the kanoim. So we were all aghast and all upset. And the truth is, I'm not sure if that was the appropriate, there might've been a lesser solution to the problem, but let's say they had torn the posters down. How many of us were so deeply offended that somebody would have gone to Mea Shearim and put up such advertisements, which was truly a violation of the communal norms in Mea Shearim? I don't expect, listen, if it's in, pick your other neighborhood, I don't know, you know, I don't want to say Katamon, right? If a Haredi from person, from Meir Sharm, comes into Katamon, and he doesn't like the advertisements. But look, this is Rome. We're in Rome. People do things as the Romans do. Okay, but I don't know how many of us said, look, you should have burned the bus shelter, but it was deeply problematic and deeply offensive, the cultural insensitivity to the people in Meir Sharm to put up these posters. Now, again, maybe the people putting it up weren't thinking about it, but certainly I suspect that if they'd been asked to take it down, they wouldn't have been so fast to take it down. They would have said, oh, it's our right to do so. Rabbi Lipstein?
Yeah, but
chutneys
is not a communal
law. No, this is not chutneys. This is not chutneys here, in the Gemara here.
Oh, oh.
That there was one opinion. The standard opinion is this was a red garment. It was a total violation of tznius. It was, I mean, one of the questions that someone pointed out you could have asked was chutneys. How did somebody else know it was chutneys? But okay. But the point is, no, it was the manner of dress that was pritzos. So that's what almost all the Rishonim say. And he was like so taken aback. How dare you behave this way in the community? So again, I think, again, we live in a multicultural society where our attitude is live and let live because it's to our benefit. And we like it too. I'm not saying it's just a pragmatic issue that we're a potentially persecuted minority. We kind of have gotten used to that idea. And it's not just us. As I said last week, Rav Papa Nabai, also we're used to that norm, right? Clearly, Rav Ada Rava was willing to say, Lo ye'osachein bimkomeinu mila shem elai. And Rav Papa Rav Ada Rava would have said, yeah, that's the way what they're wearing these days. So I think that, again, I'm not, maybe it indicates a lack of my Mesiras Nefesh or my failings. I might not be the one running to do it, but I think if you were to find sort of the equivalent of an absolute offensive violation of communal norms, I think that's how you have to understand the context of this Gemara. Maybe it's not fully satisfying, but I think it maybe shouldn't be quite as jarring as when we first encounter it. That's what I think, yes.
The question is, so you're saying this is something that anyone, not just Rav Papa, should have done because of communal law.
That's what the Gemara implies, yeah.
Another way of looking at him, because he himself says, if only I had waited.
So I said last week, I don't know if I said this in Shir, I know Zell, I think I wrote this to the email.
So is it Kanayim Pogenbo? Is it one of those things where you say, an individual person who is so motivated can do something, even though it's Halacha is not to do that.
I am more inclined to say,
was that a sign of his Mesiras Nefesh that he himself admits, maybe I should have been more under control, but I was so incensed by this.
So that is a possible. That is not what I had suggested. That's one possible reading it. What I suggested last week is it maybe that the fact that the Gemara says that the story didn't end well for him is sort of, you know, it's like, to take a famous example of this. I'm from the people who don't drink at all on Purim. It's a minority opinion to be shown who say you're not supposed to drink at all. Where does that come from? Because the Gemara in Megillah says that you're supposed to get smashed on Purim until you can't tell the difference between Arham and Baruch Mordechai. Then the Gemara tells the story. One time, Rab and Rav Zeira had Purim suited together. Rabba got so smashed that the Gemara says, come Rabba v'shachten the Rav Zeira. He slaughtered him. No, exactly what he did to him. When he woke up sober, Rabba, he realized what he had done, and he was mispalo, and Rav Zeira got better. Next year, Rabba comes to Rav Zeira and says, let's make Purim suit. Rav Zeira said, miracles don't happen all the time. So Rabbeinu Ephraim is quoted, I think, by the Meiri and others, as saying, the story in the Gemara is a masa listener. It's the show. We don't pass them that way. Now, so Rabbeinu Ephraim said, you don't drink at all. There's no bits of getting drunk at all in Purim. The position of the Ramah, particularly in Shulchan Aruch, that you drink a little bit, a little more than you do, you take a nap, and then you don't know the difference, is sort of taking the Masa Listor partially. In other words, we don't accept the entire statement. We say, Chayav Adam Basum Eporia, but only a little bit, not to the point where you're totally smashed, you don't know what you're doing. So one could read the story in the same way here. It's a little bit of Masa Listor. It's like the impulse is the correct impulse, but you have to think carefully before you do it. Right. Sometimes you have to think carefully in his case because he made a mistake in evaluating the precise circumstances and it costs a lot of money. Sometimes you have to think whether a strong reaction, whether getting up from the pulpit and calling up the people, the men wearing shorts and shul, is that going to be productive or counterproductive? Right. So it could be that the story of the Gemara, that the conclusion of the story is to tell us that the impulse was correct, but you have to channel the impulse a little more properly than Rav Bar Ava did. You know, which might make everybody happy in terms of an answer to this particular story. Because to say that the impulse was wrong would seem to run counter to the whole point of Abayi citing, right? Why would Abayi cite this story and say they were Moser Nefesh and Shem Shamayim, Al Kiddush Hashem, and then if he thinks it's totally wrong. But on the other hand, he does choose to tell the industry. He could have just left the story right there and said he tore the thing off the shelf. You see? Now, you could say that the purpose of reciting, of telling us that it cost the money, is that he took a risk for God. It happens to be this time he lost, right? Maybe it's not to say that it was wrong. It's just he was so devoted to Ribbono Shel Olam, Kiddush Hashem, that even though we could have figured that maybe he was making a mistake, he would rather err on that side. He'll pay the 400 to us. Okay. Anyway, I don't know the answer to the question. I think it's fair to note that it's a little jarring to the contemporary modern Western modern Orthodox Jew. That's, I think, certainly fair to note. And the question is, to what extent are we right? To what extent are we sort of factoring in our worldview, which maybe was different than Chazal's? Okay. Yeah, but the conclusion of the Gemara is clearly he had no business doing it for a non-Jewish woman. That I think is clear. And even if they're mitzvah l'arayas, we don't assume. Again, I think it's about violation of communal norm. So it doesn't sound like he thought it was his business. The Gemara thought it was his business if she weren't Jewish. It's not the Jewish community, right? Obviously, Jewish communities did not live hermetically sealed off from their surrounding non-Jewish communities. So you interact, you might walk in the streets in New York City. I presume our reaction would be different, you know, seeing the dress of a particular person, if they're just some unknown person, probably not Jewish, unrelated, versus you see a Ramah student walking in, you know, in the streets of Manhattan dressed in any particular way. Clearly you have a slightly different reaction because your expectations are different. Okay, fine.
So just one, maybe one of the points would be that his immediate behavior before finding out what is the situation is part of the lesson that, you know, tearing down a flag, burning a bus station is not going over to a person and physically assaulting them in some way or fashion. And before you do that to another person, you better find out what the story is.
So I think the answer, I think, yes, that's part of the lesson. I also might not burn down the bus shelter so fast. There might be other ways of doing it. When all else fails, maybe we can make an argument. But, you know, again, I'm not going to be the one and have enough trouble striking the match. And if I did, I probably wouldn't even manage to get a fire burning anyway. But anyway, yes. Isaac, you can say something.
I think the message is don't do what he did.
Yes, but the question is Abaye is praising. Clearly, the story didn't end well, and clearly he shouldn't have done it, especially if you take the interpretation matun means mitinot, patience, you know, waiting to judge. You know, clearly that it wasn't 100% right. You know, it was some percentage right, but not 100% right. And the question is, what was right, what was wrong? Okay.
I don't know if you want to comment also on the he was measures like this responsible for why their tefillos were answered.
So last week I commented I think that the person that Mesiras Nefesh on Kiddush Hashem indicates that you have a relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam. And you're not just going with the flow and this is what the community does. It means I have a passion for Kiddush Ribbono Shel Olam. So when I see someone engaged in misbehavior, I am deeply offended. You know, so if you have a relationship with someone, you want to call someone to ask them a favor. Right, we all understand that it's much easier if you have a relationship with them. Then you pick up the phone, you call them, and you're comfortable asking, and they're more likely to respond to you. So if you have a relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, so then Ribbono Shel Olam, you ask him for something, and he responds.
Kiddush Hashem is even a strong Kiddush. That means you put yourself on the line for that other for Hashem. Just like, you know, I can call somebody to ask for a favor, they're more likely to respond. If I've gone out of my way to help them, you know,
Okay, now it's a slightly, although a little funny Gemara as well. I couldn't imagine this happening today. Just a piece of background to the next Gemara. There was an ancient belief. It appears in Chazal, I'm pretty sure this is not limited to Chazal, that the image, I don't know if it was just a woman or a man as well, that images that a woman had in her mind when she was conceiving a child during the sexual act, or around that time, the images would actually have an impact on the shape of the child. There's a Gemara in Kamsa Bar Kamsa, in Gittin, the Tisha B'Av Gemaras, in which they tell the story of the Romans taking these beautiful young Jewish captives and tying them to their bed when they would be engaged in intercourse with their wives. with the hope that the children would look like that. Okay, clearly not. Clearly they are not working on the principles of genetics here. I'm not even sure it's Lamarckian, but it's closer to Lamarckian than Darwin. So this, I assume this was a very common belief in the ancient world. Maybe Yaakov with the sheep. That's a quite, obviously that's a complicated what exactly, but yeah, that's a possibility. That might have been the only possibility, but there is this idea. So in light, it would seem in light of that. That'll be the second story. Hold on 1 second. But the first story isn't that way. First, but they're both stories of rabbis, and this is what would not happen today, waiting outside the mikvah. So the first story is Rav Gidel Havaragil, the Habak, this is in the middle of the Chaf on the base, right at the two dots. It's almost a little just past the middle of the page. Rav Gidel Havaragil, the Havakazil, the Yosef Ashari the Tfila. Rav Gidel would sit by the gateway to the mikvahs. Omar Lahu, he would give instructions. Hachi Tavilu, Lahachi Tavilu. He would, in other words, you know, today they put posters up in the mikveh giving you instructions, like in the Kalim, at least in the Kalim mikveh. In the mikveh, when women go to the mikveh, so they have a mikveh they eat to help along. But in the Kalim mikveh, they put up posters. So this was like a poster, but I guess they didn't have a printing press. It wasn't easy to put up the poster. How many people were literate anyway? So he would be standing there barking out instructions. You go to the mikveh, make sure you know chatzitza, et cetera, et cetera. So they said to him, yes, Amri le Rabbanon, the Rabbanon said to Rav Gidel, Loko Hamistafi Mar Meyetzer Hara. Aren't you? Listen, I mean, I understand that you're going there for productive purpose, but here you're going there. All these women are going to the mikveh. You know, the next thing there, I mean, it wasn't always true, but probably in Bava was true. They didn't have Tumah V'Tahara in Bava. In Eretz Yisrael, a single woman went to the mikveh also. It had nothing to do with the marital relation. I mean, it also did, but was not primarily about marital relations. It's about Tumah V'Tahara. So aren't you afraid of the Yetzer Hara? So he said to them, Amar Lahu, Damin Bapai Ki Kachi Chivari, they're like white geese in my eyes. In other words, he claimed he had no Yetzirah. Okay. So you have such an expression, actually. This is actually quoted. I'm pretty sure this Gemara is quoted along with another Gemara in Ksubos. The Gemara in Ksubos tells a story, I think it was Rabbi Zeira, who used to put the kala on his shoulders during the wedding. Now, today that would be an absolute scandal. But his Talmidim said to him, can we do that? So he said, if she feels, if your reaction to that is like you're carrying a beam, a wooden beam on your shoulders, meaning it means nothing to you in the sexual sense, then it's permitted. So I believe that Gemara I know, and I think that this Gemara perhaps as well, is quoted by the Ritva at the end of a Kiddushin. The Gemara there is talking about, I know this will strange, very sounds strange to us in multiple ways, but the Gemara there tells a story. They didn't censor themselves very much. Two Amoraim, a father-in-law and a son-in-law. So the father-in-law picked up his granddaughter, who was a little girl, put her in her lap. So the son-in-law says to his father-in-law, to this little girl's grandfather, don't you know that I accepted Kiddushin for her? Now, why it should be prohibited for him to hold his granddaughter if she's now technically Mekudeshes as an Eishes Ish, as opposed to if she's just his granddaughter, which is also an Arab, I don't know why there's any such distinction. But that was the question. So he responds to his son-in-law, don't you know that Rav said that you're not allowed to marry your daughter off until she becomes a Gdola and says, I want to marry so-and-so? And then he says in response to his father-in-law, don't you know what he was, Rav says, Emishtam Shabbi Isha Klal? That's what the expression is, Emishtam Shabbi Isha Klal. So the Gemara says, and the grandfather held, Hakol L'Shem Shamayim. Now, what does that mean? So Rashi says, because he wants to show his daughter love, and he does that by showing love for his grandchildren. Now, so that's what the Gemara says. Now, the Ritva comments there. Now, you realize how Kol Hashem Shamayim is a very, very dangerous expression. I do things, you know, when someone, we are supposed to educate our children that when somebody, an authority figure, or somebody you have a connection with, asks you to do things that make you uncomfortable, you should say no, we should run in the opposite direction. We tell our children, when you meet someone with charisma, we tell children to run as fast as you can the other way. But the point is, we should teach our children that if a authority figure tells you to violate yichud with them, that already is an automatic red flag, right? Now, these people would say they're doing it to Shem Shamayim, et cetera. We know where, unfortunately, so many of these things have ended. So what exactly is this expression of Kol Shem Shamayim? This is crazy, right? I'm eating chazir today, but it's the Shem Shamayim, you know, because... So the answer is, and it's quoted by the Ramah. I mean, the Ramah quotes this Gemara, this Ritva, effectively, but the Ritva says in Shulchan Aruch, is that certain gedarim, certain fences that we have in arayos, don't apply if there's not really a concern. Right? It's not, I don't know about, in KJ it might be a little different, but most, I would say in my shul in Pina, men and women as a general don't shake hands. They say good job, but they don't shake hands. Now, is it osur to do so? So the simple interpretation is no, because of this Gemara. Right, shaking a hand is not normally. It's not. What's that? It's not. It doesn't have any sexual overtones to it. So in our community, it's very common from people don't because we have extra fences, if you want to put it that way. But it's not technically awesome. When someone comes to me, what do I do when I'm going to an interview? Do I shake the person's hand? Of course, you shake the person's hand. It's not awesome. We don't do it in our community typically. It's a good thing. It might be a good thing, but it's not that it's awesome. You have to realize that in a context where someone else would be offended. You know, then, and especially because they don't know your cultural norms. So of course, if it were usher, you'd have a bigger problem. It's not usher. So I believe that this may also be another one of the Gemaras. How could, it's not appropriate for him to sit outside of Shari Tila. He said, if she's doma, you know, like a white geese, so it's not a problem for me. I think the Ritva says about either this or the one in Ksubos, he said, not everybody should do that one, right? Clearly, we would look askance if the rabbi, the shul, put the kala on his shoulders, you know. So he says to them, I'm not concerned because I don't really have a Yetzer Hara. Okay, a Yetzer Hara for this, a Yetzer Hara at this stage in life, whatever it was, this wasn't a concern. Okay, comes the next, the Rama talks, quotes this Gemara from Kiddushin. He quotes the Ebn Ezer in the context, I mean, they did things that I think we would never allow doing, but it sounds like from the Rama that when the men would bathe in the bathhouses, there were non-Jewish shvachos who would help them with pour water and so on. Which today we would think to be totally inappropriate if the men are in the bathhouse to be made, you know, if you need assistance, there would be male assistance, I think. But that's what it sounds like they did in Ashkenaz. I'll tell you the issue also, it comes up very commonly an issue. If you have a barber who's, let's say a man has a barber who's a woman, right? He's cutting her hair, right? There's going to be physical contact. Without that Gemara, we would say it's inappropriate, but I think in light of that Gemara, I think it's not an issue. Okay. Anyway, so now the Gemara tells another story. But a little different. Rabbi Yochanan have a rugil to have a ka'azah with Yosef Ashari the tefillah. Rabbi Yochanan used to do the same thing. Why did he go? Amar, he sulkin benos Yisrael of Asyan mitfilah mistaklundi. When they come up from the base of tefillah, they'll look at me, they'll see me. Rabbi Yochanan was supposed to be a very, very handsome man, although he also couldn't grow a beard, apparently. And there's a Gemara in Shabbos that says Rabbi Yochanan used to call manai mechabdosai. His clothing were that which is lechabit. So some say, because he didn't have a hadrazah. But okay, anyway, Rabbi Yochanan was certainly a very handsome man when he met his brother-in-law, his later-to-be brother-in-law, Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish looked at him and said, Shufreich Lenoshe, your beauty should be for women. I don't know if it meant that women should have your beauty or a guy like you should be chased by the women. And he said to Rabbi Reish Lakish, who was a bandit at the time and not an observant Jew, he said, Cheilech La'oraiso, your physical strength should be for Torah. So Rabbi Yochanan was this very handsome person. He said, then look at me, and they have very handsome and beautiful children. So now, Amri Le Rabbanan, the sages said, Lo kamastampi marma in a bisha? Aren't you afraid of the ayin harat now? What's interesting here, some of the, I think Rishonim asked, or Achronim asked, wasn't he afraid of the Yetzer Hara? So they say Rabbi Yochanan had very long eyelashes, and they used to droop down. So normally, he had to kind of lift them up to see. So the answer is his eyes were closed. He wasn't seeing the women, but they were seeing him. So the concern was ayin hara, right? In other words, when you display what you have publicly, ostentatiously, that's an invitation for ayin hara. Your beauty, your wealth, your knowledge, that's an invitation for ayin hara. So they asked, aren't you afraid of that? So Amar Lahu, he said to them, I'm not afraid. Anami Zara de Yosef Basina. I come from the descendants of Yosef, the Lo Shalta Be'in Abisha. Yosef's children, descendants aren't subject to the ayin hara. Now, it's interesting here, firstly, by the Rabbi Yochanan is apparently, according to his own account, unless it was from his mother's side, is not from Shevet Yehuda or Binyamin, right? He has to be either from Shevet Ephraim or Menashe to be from the descendants of Yosef. Why was Yosef not subject to the Ayin Hara, according to Chazal? It was a reward for him, because he chose not to be Nene. I believe there are maybe two different versions of this, but they say that when Yosef was coronated by Paro, so he went out on Egypt. So the Targumim, on Bein Poras Yosef, Bein Poras Ale Ayin, in Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov's bracha for Yosef. So all the Targumim of Eretz Yisrael quote this very long expansion, not in the text, about how Yosef was going, and all the young Egyptian women were dressed to the nines. and they were trying, they were throwing stuff, trying to attract his attention, but Yosef kept his eyes down not to be men, not to inappropriately benefit. And because of that, he was rewarded, you know, with protection from the Ayin Hara. The other version is he wasn't Menem Eishes Adonah from Eishes Potiphar, and he was rewarded with protection for the Ayin Hara. One of the interesting comments somebody I'm going to make here is that our eyes are the one thing that we have almost no control over, what we see. We can control what we say. There are a lot, but you walk into a situation, and the one thing you can't control, you just see. You know, we talk about how you saw something and you can't unsee it well. So Yosef was very careful about that. He was rewarded with protection from the Ayin Hara. How do you know that? So the Gemara says, "Dechsev bein poros Yosef bein poros ale ayin." The Amar Rabbi Abahu al tikre ale ayin, which means on. Al is a poetic. Ale is a poetic form of al. Ela ole ayin. He goes up from the eye. He's removed from the eye. The eye has no control. Has no. Does not rule over him. And then. And Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanina, Amar Mehacha, from a different pasuk, Yaakov's bracha to Yosef to Menashe and Ephraim, v'yidgul arov b'kerav ha'aretz. They should multiply like fish in the midst of the land. Madogim shebiyam, mayim mechasim aleim ve'ein ha'ayin harashal. Let us fem azaro shal Yosef, ein ayin harashal. Let us fem. Oh, I think that I conflate something. The Gemara has both those interpretations. So the second one is that that there's the bracha to be like dogim from Yaakov, and the third is the ibayseima ayin shalu ratzitzal lasan mimash ein shalom ein ayin harashal let us know. Rashi says he didn't want to benefit from Eishes Adonai. Okay, so that's where the Gemara leaves this particular sugya. Okay, so that is the sugya of Kavod Abrios. That's the whole discussion. This is obviously, in some ways, an important sugya. The Gemara here, however, attaches two very important limitations to the application of Kavod Abrios. Number one, it doesn't override prohibitions of the Torah unless they are passive. And I think it's important, I've said this a few times, to understand what Kavod Abrios is. Kavod Abrios means a sense of shame. The shame could be, the Gemara in Shabbos has a number of instances related to cleaning oneself after using the bathroom, for, you know, personal hygiene. Shame could be the issues of clothing. Shame is not liking a particular halacha of the halachic system. Okay. Yes, Isaac.
At the Tahara, we also put Afar Eretz Yisrael on the eyes because the Chippur of Nusawamu and the eyes are the ones that you can't control.
Sure. Okay.
According to the Mavriyavu.
There you go. All right. The Mishnah on the top of Chok Amar Aleph, we're now back to more brachos type issues. The Mishnah says the following: Nashim va'avadim ketanim. So women, eved kenanis, and ketanim. We have to talk about what type of a katan, what kind of a minor, are peturim mikriyashma umin hatzfilin. They are exempt from kriyashma and tefillin. The chayovim, they're obligated in tefila, mezuzah, and birchas hamazon. Now I won't dictate what the minog of the women of Klal Yisrael is, and the Magen Avraham, in a very famous defense of the women of Klal Yisrael, argues that they're not obligated to daven the way men are obligated to daven three times a day, and it might be enough that they say Moda'ani. But the simple interpretation of the Mishnah and the simple interpretation of the Shulchan Aruch is that women are supposed to daven at least Shachris and Mincha. The same way that men are obligated to daven Shachris Mincha, men are obligated to daven Arv as well because we accepted it as an obligation. It's not clear if that applies to women, which leads to very interesting kinds of shilas. For example, if a woman forgot to daven Mincha, when should she daven a second Shemot Esrei? Should she daven Arv if she doesn't normally daven Arv, or should she wait till Shachris next? And Tosfos can talk about these kinds of questions. But the Mishnah says that women are exempt. Women, an Eved Kenani who has not the same Kedusha, he has a lesser Kedusha. A woman has a full Kedusha Yisrael. And Eved Kenani doesn't have a full Kedusha Yisrael, but there's overlap in terms of the mitzvahs in which they're obligated. And a katan are exempt from Kriya Shema and Tefillin. Now, I'm going to leave out the katan for the moment. That's what makes things complicated. But the fact that a woman and an Eved Kenani are exempt from Kriya Shema and Tefillin is because women, and thereby Avadam as well, are exempt from mitzvah saseh shehazman grama, time-dependent mitzvahs. Generally speaking, with few exceptions, women are exempt. The Mishnah and Kiddushin in the first perek, in the latter part of the perek, tells us that kol mitzvah aseh she'as man grama, anoshim chayavin, anoshim are peturos, except for three mitzvahs. And then, at the same time, every mitzvah which is not zman grama, is not time dependent. Men and women are equally obligated, except for three mitzvos, three prohibitions that women are exempt from: bal tashchis, bal takif, and bal tetame lemesim. Most women don't have a beard, but if they did have facial hair, shaving off the corners of the razor is not a problem. Going around the head is not a problem, and a bas kohen is allowed to defile herself to mesim. That is the general rule. So Kriya Shema and Tefillin, we would assume that makes sense. They are mitzvah sasehah sman grama. Kriya Shema is a mitzvah sasehah sman grama because you do it during the day once and during the night once. And Tefillin is a mitzvah sasehah sman grama, either because the mitzvah Tefillin is only during the day, which is one sheet in the Gemara, which the Rambam paskins like, but most Rishonim paskin like the other opinion, that there's a mitzvah Tefillin mid-oraisa even at night, but there's a rabbinic gezera not to wear Tefillin at night for whatever reasons. But even those opinions would agree there's no mitzvah of wearing tefillin on Shabbos or Yom Tov, and therefore it is a mitzvah saseh shahazman grama. It applies at some time, not at other times. Okay, so that's the mishnah, and then the other is tefillah. The tefillah is interesting. Is tefillah mitzvah saseh shahazman grama? It would on the surface appear to be so. Birchas hamazon, eating food, and may benching clearly does not seem to be mitzvah saseh shahazman grama. And mezuzah isn't either. Mezuzah is supposed to be on the doorpost all of the time. Now, what is interesting in my question that I asked about tefillah is, does this exemption of mitzvah saseh she'asman grama for women, does that apply even by mitzvahs that are derabbanan or only by doraisas? So that's actually going to be a machlokas, perhaps a machlokas Rashi and Tosis. We'll talk about that in a little bit when we get there. But the only thing the Gemara will deal with briefly is, why does the Mishnah have to list these examples? We already have the Mishnah and Kiddushin. The Mishnah and Kiddushin gives us the rule. Mitzvah saseh she'asman grama, women are exempt. Lo shelo asman grama, they're not exempt. And the Mishnah here has just listed two examples. Yes, three examples. Now, why are these examples here? I know why they're here in the sense that this we're learning about Kriya Shema. So once we're talking about Kriya Shema, why does the Mishnah actually need to tell us that? So the Gemara will explore that. But first I want to grapple with the question of a katan. What kind of a katan? Are katanim exempt from Kriya Shema? Katanim are exempt from all mitzvahs. But if that's the case, there's no point even listing that a katan is not obligated in mezuzah. Katan is not obligated in tefillah. Katan is not obligated in birchas hamazon. So why would the katan be, in other words, if you're going to say this, a katan is obligated in those things, why isn't he obligated in Kriya Shema and tefillin as well? So Rashi here writes on the Mishnah, Ketanim, the bottom Rashi, the second line from the bottom. Afilu katan shehigia lechinuch, lo hitilu al aviv lechanuchu b'kriyashma, lefi she'enu matzoi tamen kishemagia zman kriyashma. Very interesting. So Rashi says, what's that? Yes and no. I think it's true only because I imagine the ketanim got up later and went to sleep earlier. And if someone was actually saying kriyashma is his first act of the morning, and his last act of eating, which is not what we do, then indeed the katan wouldn't be available. He'd be sleeping probably. But Rashi is obviously sensitive to the problem that if the latter half of the Mishnah says that a katan, an isha and eved and a katan are obligated in tefillah, in mezuzah, in birchas hamazon, a katan can only be obligated in those if he's a katan shehegia lechinuch, he's reached the age appropriate, the appropriate age for being educated in that particular mitzvah. A 2-year-old, there's no issue, there's no mitzvah chinuch. A 2-year-old doesn't even have a clue. Can't, you know, maybe precocious 2-year-olds, really precocious 2-year-olds, but normally there's no expectation. There's no expectation. So Rashi says the entire Mishnah is presumably dealing, Rashi assumes, with the same kind of a katan. One or the other, either higia lechinuch has reached the age of chinuch or hasn't reached the age of chinuch. So Rashi says it's a katan shehigia lechinuch because the second half of the Mishnah says he's obligated in these three mitzvahs. So then the question is, why is the katan exempt from kriya shema and tefillin higia lechinuch? So Rashi says because this is one mitzvah chachamim didn't make the father responsible for because it's not pragmatic to do it, right? You're not going to wake your kid up. You want to make him hate Judaism. Wake him up every morning. Get up, get him, get him, say kriya shema. I mean, that's really not, you know. You know, we understand. I have during during, it is so against my nature, Rabbi Lipstein, you'd be proud of me, but at my shul, my driveway shul, that's been running all year. So not only was I effectively the gabbai, the balkore, often the baltfila, not the people who would daven and spell me, and effectively the president also of our minyan, but I was also the candy man. My wife made me be the candy man. So she buy the candy, and I was the one who had to, you know, and she, of course she's correct, because she's always right, right? I that was not my version of shul, but the truth is you want kids to come to shul, they have to, you have to be first sometimes shalol lishma, shalol lishma, bal lishma, you know. So, I have a very good friend who's was in the rabbinate, you know, in a big shul, not in New York. And when he moved in, he knew the previous rabbi used to give, I forget what he used to give, but he knew he had to have a signature mark, and the kids would come up, wish him a good Shabbos. It's so against the way I think about the world, but the truth is, you know, there are people who write stories about how they first started going to shul and eventually became actually observant, was because they spent the young years of their life primarily in the pursuit of sugar. And eventually, you know, so that made, they dragged their families to shul because they wanted to get candy from the rabbi or whoever it was. So anyway, the last thing you want to do is every day make the katan miserable just to say Kriya Shema when it's only because of chinuch. So you have to know what's appropriate for what age and what stage. And then regarding tefillin, Rashi writes on the first Rashi on the next Amud, on top of couple of days, Uminat tefillin, Mishum distan katan eino yodea lishmar gupo shelo yafiach bahem. In order to wear tefillin, you have to be very careful to keep your body in effect clean. You cannot be flatulating. And therefore, because it's not inappropriate with the kedusha of tefillin, tefillin has the shem Hashem in it. It has real kedusha, unlike tzitzis. And therefore, you have to have someone who's a little more mature. So that's what Rashi says, that these arkitanim who reach the age where they would be appropriate to daven, to say birchas hamazon, they're exempt from kriya shema tefillin because there are two specific individualized reasons for these mitzvahs that it's not pragmatic to be mechanichah. And in fact, even though Tosis is going to push back on this Rashi, the truth is that is our practice today. We give a katan tzitzis, arba minim, birchas hamazon, all these things, kriya shema even. We do this all from a fairly young age, but the minhag, at least amongst Ashkenazim, I don't know if Sfaradim did differently, is we do not have a katan put on tefillin until right before the bar mitzvah. There are various minhagim. Some people, more typically I've seen it's a month, some people will do it less, some people will do it longer, but the idea is that basically we need chinuch for a katan, but we restrict tefillin because of their kedusha. Generally speaking, we restrict tefillin to those who are obligated to wear tefillin to the sort of a minimum amount of time wearing tefillin. If someone walked in and was wearing tefillin, I once had this actually, a very interesting student who was entering YU Smicha, and he was going to be in my shir. I didn't know him, but somebody gave me a heads up that he would wear a hat during the day, be wearing tefillin underneath wearing tefillin. I don't know if this, he was overlapped with yours.
I don't remember.
And so I saw this coming. It's like, okay, what are we going to do here? So I spoke to the student and I said, and he was very resistant. So I said, let's go talk to Rosh Hechter. Would you agree? Let Rosh Hechter decide. And I can't tell the full story, but Rosh Hechter agreed with me. He said, you shouldn't wear your tefillin during the day. It's hilarious. But so the bottom line is that we frown upon anybody not obligated to wear tefillin, wearing tefillin, which includes a man who might be obligated in theory, but in the off time. So basically we put it on for Shachris and we're done after that. You know, maybe someone is like a Gadol B'Yisrael who's an Adam Kadosh, maybe. But outside of that, I know that there's some people walking around in Eretz Yisrael in certain towns wearing tefillin beyond, and they probably shouldn't be doing it. But, okay, so Ketanim, we take the same approach. We don't allow a Katan to wear tefillin until right before his bar mitzvah. We don't want to wait till after his bar mitzvah because he's got to be able to do the mitzvah. He needs a little practice, but just a little practice. So that's where Rashi leaves us. Now, Tosfos was bothered by this because, really, there's no chinuch for kriya shema and tefillin also. Tefillin also, there's a gemara that says katan sheyodea lishmar tefillin, a katan who knows how to properly keep tefillin. So his father buys some tefillin. So Tosfos writes on the bottom of Chaf Amud Aleph, turn back. Peirush hakuntres katan shehigia lechinuch. He says a katan shehigia lechinuch v'lo nehira. This doesn't make sense. The perik mulav agazol amrinan hayodea lishmar tefillin avuv chay lechnosol tefillin. Alma, you see that kishigi lechinuch the shaychi batfilin chayi batfilin. So in other words, you can't say, in other words, katan shigi lechinuch can be different ages for different mitzvahs. But presumably, your rabbi is assuming that a katan that across the Mishnah, when we Mishnah says katan, katan is exempt, katan is obligated, it's the same kind of a katan. It doesn't mean it's the same age for every mitzvah, but there are two categories of katan. a katan who has reached the age of chinuch for a particular mitzvah, or a katan who hasn't. So Tosa says it doesn't make sense to say when the katan is pater from tefillin in the Mishnah, it's because we don't want katanim doing it because they won't be careful. The Gemara in Sukkah says a katan shehigia lechinuch, who reached the age where he knows how to be careful with tefillin, so he's chayiv in tefillin. I mean, his father has to get him tefillin. So you should. So it doesn't make sense, the Mishnah, if it's a katan shehigia lechinuch. And then Tosa says on his own, even though there's no explicit Gemara, ubi kriyas shemanam yesh lechayiv yosem mistam l'medash katan hasam. When as soon as a child learns to talk, we teach the child Torah Tzivalan Moshe, and we teach the child Shema. So you, the first thing you teach the child when it's little Shema, so you tell me there's no mitzvah. I mean, the truth is, you don't have to be honest. You don't have to wake your child up at the crack of dawn and keep him up late until the sun sets, you know, at 10:30 at night to say Kriya Shema. In the morning, you have plenty of time to say Kriya Shema. At night, so you say Kriya Shema after plug. Why can't you be Mechayim?
Interesting, because I just noticed in this tomorrow a few times, this Rashi's language on the Ketanim Keturim, Kotan Shehigia Lechinuch Lavitilo Al Aviv Lekanuch Lo B'Kriyas Shema Lepi She'en Lo Motzo Yitomid Kishemagia Man Kriyas Shema. In other words, he's looking at when the Chiyam for Kriyas Shema begins, which is, whenever
crack it on, a little after right. Crack it on,
and then the cotton probably is not awake, whereas Tosas probably is not thinking the same way exactly.
Well maybe not. In other words, I you know, Rashi seems to have what I would call a very romantic view of the world, which is that of all the men are, of course, saying Kriya Shema, you know, Mishayakir. It's like a halavai. Although maybe in Rashi's time it was true, people used to rise very early, even before the sun came out. They would go to sleep early, as soon as it got dark. So yes, Tosis doesn't tell you how to do it, but presumably he would say, do it later. Or he would say, listen, if the katan's not up, you don't have to drag him out of bed, but if he's up, there's a mitzvah to be mechanech. So he says, so that explains nicely why the katan is exempt from Kriya Shema and Tefillin, but now you have to explain why is a katan shelohi gil chinuch obligated in the last three things of the Mishnah. Umiu sefa de katani the chayav mitzvila, haya ri wrote zelomar de mayu be katan shi gil chinuch, the ilohi gil chinuch lohav el chayav mitzvila. So the ri, Rabbi Nutam's nephew, wanted to say the second half of the Mishnah must be a katan who was a gil chinuch, because otherwise why would he chayav? The Tosa says v'lo mehira. The MK Lohabalu Kitanim Dunya Dinashim Avadim Shepturim Bechalim, or Kitanim Enam Peturim Elabashaloigia, the Enya de la Shwatila. If you're going to say that the Mishnah is talking about in the Resha, a Katan Shaloigia Lechino, in the Seif, a Katan Shaikia Lechino, so then it's not it's not consistent, right? It's not, in other words, the Noshim and Avadim Apturim from these first two mitzvahs are always Turim, but the Kitanim, it depends. The entire Mishnah is katan shelo higia lechinuch. We're not talking about a katan shehigia lechinuch. He's not enlisted in this category, so don't ask me about distinctions. You see, for the Ri, once you say that the Mishnah is talking about two different kinds of katanim, then the Resha, the first part, makes no sense to lump katanim with dashan avadin, because some katanim are liable, like the ones in the second half of the Mishnah. But for Rabbi Natam, where we're only talking about an entire Mishnah, katan shalohi gilachino, so then you can't ask me questions, why are katanim not similar to nashim ravadim? They are. Any katan shalohi gilachino is like an isha and an eved, because our Mishnah is only talking about katanim who haven't reached the age to be told. Ah, but now what do you do with the second half of the Mishnah? He says, the chayav in the seifa, the end of the third to last line in Tosos, right at the end. The chayav in the seifa, the second half of the Mishnah that says they're obligated, is only kai anashim ravadim l'chud. So Rabbi Natan says that the second half of the Mishnah, Ketanim are not obligated. You'll ask, but the Mishnah says, Nashim Avadim Ketanim are Pturim from this, Chayim that. So the Mishnah, the first half of the Mishnah goes on all three. The second half of the Mishnah only goes on Nashim and Avadim. So now the question is, V'im Tomar, Im Kain, Amai Tana Ketanim Bahadei Nashim Avadim. Why list Ketanim in the Mishnah? Came under Einam Shav to the Brisha. So now the Resha and the Seifa is inconsistent. The Resha then applies to Nashim Avadim and Tanim. The Seifa is then the second half, the Mishnah applies only to Nashim and Avadim. He says, V'yesh lomar, dechein derech hatana lishnos niachat, Nashim Avadim uptanim shalagil achinuch, kimo Nashim Avadim kitanim peturim sukh. So Rabbi Tam says that's the way the Tana frequently find a lot of Tanaitic sources, where you say, Nashim Avadim uptanim, they are the prototype of people who are not obligated in the mitzvah. So, and Tosas said, Rabbi Tam says, it particularly kitanim shalagil achinuch. And that's why the Mishnah list uses this phrase. But in reality, yes, it would have been better off if the Mishnah just said, Nashim Avadim are Ptur Mikriya Shema Umenatilin and are obligated in Tzvila, Mizuzah, and Birchas Hamazon. Okay, fine. So now the Gemara wants to know why the Mishnah has to tell us these demons. So we start on the second line of Chafam Beis, the first words in the Gemara. Kriya Shema Pshita Mitzvah Sasei Shesman Gramahu. Why would I think a woman is chayiv in Kriya Shema? It's a mitzvah that she's man grama. So the Gemara says, "Mahu d'tema hoel v'is b'malchus shemayim kamashvela." I would have thought that this Kriya Shema is so central. It's kabbalah samalchus shemayim. It's accepting the yoke of the Ribono Shel Olam upon oneself that even women would be obligated in. Now the truth is, so the Gemara says that's why the Mishnah has to tell you now. The truth be told, the Gemara does lead me to the question. That seems like such a compelling reason. Why not? I don't know the answer to the question. That seems to be a pretty compelling reason. But the Gemara says, nonetheless, it's a mitzvah sasatious man grama. And there are exempt. One note about this mitzvah sasatious man grama. We dealt with this sugya earlier at the beginning of the second parak. There was a machlokas, chachmei svarad and chachmei ashkenaz. If a woman volunteers to do a bracha, a mitzvah sasatious man grama, can she make a bracha? So if a woman decides that she's going to fulfill the mitzvah arba minim on Sukkot, does she make a bracha on Tidas Lom? Ashkenazi women do, Sephardi women don't. If a woman says Kriya Shema, everybody agrees that she can say Birchos Kriya Shema, because Birchos, and we discussed this, but the pashtus is Birchos Kriya Shema is not a Birchos HaMitzvah. It's a part of Tzvila in effect. Maybe it's a Birchos HaShevach, but it's really part of Tzvila, and therefore women, I'm pretty sure even Sephardi women say Birchos Kriya Shema when they're saying Kriya Shema. Okay, fine. Next. Mimatfilin, Pshita. It's also a mitzvah sasishan man grama. So the Gemara says, Mal the tema hovi iskish lemezuza kamashvilan. That tfilin, right? We have ukshartemo sam liosai etchem by yutal tapos bein echem. Or better, I'll go to the first pasuk. Ukshartem liosai edech by yutal sveinecha. Uksav tama mezuzos beisecha bisharecha. Tfilin, mezuza, you might have said that if you're obligated in one, you're obligated in the other. If you're exempt from one, you're exempt from the other. So the Gemara says that's why the Mishnah is to tell you women are exempt from tefillin. Interestingly enough, if you skip one line just for a moment, three lines to ufa mezuzah, the Gemara says pshita. Why do you have to tell us that women are obligated mezuzah? Ma'ud tema hol v'iskish latam l'torah kamash v'lam. I would have said that because v'limad hemo samas v'neichem l'daber bam, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, the second parasha of Kriya Shema, which we read yesterday in Kriya Satorah, followed immediately by that women would be exempt as well. It's kind of interesting. I think I know the answer, but why didn't the Gemara just turn around and say, well, I would have thought since women are exempt from tefillin, they're exempt from mezuzah as well. Why did they go to the second parsha?
Well, then
I think you're correct, right? Yeah. Then it would be circular, right? In other words, you'd be saying, well, I would have thought, you know, there's a heckish, you know, at the end of the day, the answer is there's no heckish. They just happen to be next to one another. I mean, they have a relationship.
Says, you know, see this word.
Unless it says see the other word, yes. Okay, fine. So now the last thing that I just want to touch upon now, the last thing we'll do, is the comment, go back a few lines now, the chayavim b'tfila. The Gemara says, the rachamei nintu. Everybody needs rachamim. Everybody needs to, and it's hard to translate this word. Literally means a request for mercy, but I would say tefillah is about a relationship with Ribono Shel. Everybody needs a relationship with Ribono Shel. Everybody needs that connection. It doesn't matter, man, woman, or even child, you know, that's a gift. That would be fine.
That the problem with that is the first piece in the Gemara, you might have thought that Kriya Shema and Malchus, Kabbalah's Malchus.
So Kabbalah's Malchus.
Which is essential to a Jewish life.
It's essential, but you can have a Kabbalah Samal Shemayim, which is there, whether I actually do the mitzvah or not. Right? If you didn't read Kriya Shema today, you would still be engaged in serving God all day. You can't have such a thing. But if you want to have a relationship with the Rosh Hashanah connection, that can't just exist in a vacuum in theory. That has something, a relationship has to be fostered, it has to be nurtured, otherwise it falls apart. That's what I saw. So Kabbalah Sama Shema has to always be present. Your relationship to Rosh Hashanah in a certain sense is much more intense at certain times than at other times. So you always have to have a sense of Kabbalah Sama Shema. And in a certain sense, the formal pronunciation is a nice thing, but it's really not the essential part. Whereas having a relationship with the Rebbeinu Shlomo, if you don't have these times in which you designate them, where you foster and nurture this relationship, then you wind up not having a relationship. That's how I would read the Gemara. And now there's a line which Rashi doesn't have, none of everybody has. The Gemara says, "Mahu the Tema, ho ksib be erev avoka vitzarayim kemitzis haseishas man brahma dami kamash v'la." You would have thought that tefillah, so this is a very different explanation. This is saying that tefillah is not a mitzvah saseh shasman grama. I would have thought it was a mitzvah saseh shasman grama, but it's not. Now, the Gemara doesn't say, well, why is it not a mitzvah saseh shasman grama? The answer might be because, in the words of Rabbi Yochanan, ulevai sheyispao adam kalayom kulam, right? So now, but here's the question. On the line of the Gemara sounds like it's saying, I would have thought tefillah is a mitzvah saseh shasman grama, because it says, erevok v'tzarayim. So kamash v'lan, that it's not a mitzvah saseh shasman grama. That's the way the Gemara reads.
Because you're always obligated.
What's that?
Because you're always obligated.
Right.
So or you're only obligated to be a tzara or something like that.
What's that?
Or you're only...
Whatever the reason, whatever the kamash v'lan is, you know, however you want to explain that, kamash v'lan, that it's not a zman grama, for whatever the reasons are. Now, if you have this line in the Gemara, it implies that if it were a mitzvah saseh shasman grama, a woman should be exempt. So Tosfos writes, the top Tosfos, writes, b'tfila pshita, keva, so they have a pshita in there. Kevan the sever of a book of its arayim, a sicha ve'ameh, kemitzis a seish man grama habe, kamash man, the rachamei nivu. Now, so now, Tosfos says, Rashi lo garis le, shari tfila the rabbanani, umay mitzis a seish shaychita. I think he's asking what mitzis a seish man grama, Rashi's saying, it's not a grounds of exemption. By a Torah mitzvah, a mitzis a seish man grama, woman exempt. There is no categorical exemption by mitzis a seish man grama if it's the rabbanan. So Tosas differs with Rashi. He says, "Mikomachom yeshu liyashi." Now you can actually defend that. The ha'halal the rabbana, the nashim peturos by high time. The mitzvah saseh shasman grama kedamrinam besukah. The Gemara in Sukkah makes clear that a woman is exempt from the mitzvah halal. Halal is a mitzvah the rabbanan. That's what Tosas assumes. There is a Bahag who counts halal as a mitzvah the raisa, the famous hasaga of the Rambam and the famous response of the Ramban to the Rambam. But Tosas assumes, like the Rambam, that halal is a mitzvah the rabbanan. Women are exempt from it. Because the mitzvah saseh shasman grama. So Tosas says the same thing might have applied here. If you thought that tefillah was actually mitzvah saseh shasman grama, that would be an exemption for women as well. That's machlokas Rashi and Tosas. I don't know if there are any specific mitzvahs that actually come up, but it seems to be at least a machlokas on a principle whether or not the exemption of mitzvah saseh shasman grama is extended to those obligations that are only rabbinic in nature. Mm. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to stop here. We will resume B'ezras Hashem Yisparach August the 29th, I believe. And we will pick up where we have left off here with the next topic, a very, very interesting sugya. If you want to cheat and look ahead at it, and there's a really interesting Baal Hamor and Ramban about this issue, about the obligation of Birchas HaMazon, the nature of woman's obligation of Birchas HaMazon, the amount that any person has to eat in order to be obligated in Birchas HaMazon in the Torah. So that will be next on our agenda.
Thank you.